loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. John Kiriakou, my co-host, is out today. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discuss the deletion of hundreds of Facebook pages and accounts by Facebook related to Sputnik or Sputnik employees. And then we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump announced his missile defense review today at the Pentagon. This includes 20 new ground-based interceptors, but also a space-based missile defense layer as the Trump administration pushes ahead with its dangerous militarization of outer space. Next, American citizen and journalist Marzia Hashmi has been detained and held by the FBI since Sunday. She is not charged with any crime, but is being held because she is a, quote, material witness. Hashmi is an anchor for Press TV, an Iranian news outlet, and was detained at the airport when she flew to the U.S. to visit her children and work on a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement. Then it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, the country, and the world. And then, two Democrats and two Republicans introduced a bill yesterday that would ban sales of U.S. technology like phone chips to Chinese companies ZTE and Huawei. Despite ongoing negotiations between U.S. and Chinese trade officials, the campaign to stop China's economic rise continues. And finally, this week, mainstream media exploded over meetings between President Trump and Russian President Putin that took place without a U.S. translator. But this is not without precedent. We'll take a look at the history of presidential diplomacy. And in other headlines, the first Prime Minister of Congo, Patrice Lumumba, was assassinated on this day in 1961. Lumumba was an icon of the global fight against colonialism and was a leader in his country's movement for freedom from Belgium. Admirers of Lumumba widely believe that the CIA had a role in his assassination. Nine people were killed and dozens wounded in a car bombing at a police academy in the Colombian capital, Bogota. There is no confirmation yet as to who or what group is responsible for the attack. Colombia's peace process, aimed at ending over 60 years of war, is deeply imperiled by the new far-right government of Iván Duque, who opposed the peace accord with the main rebel organization, FARC. Employees at the State Department are being called back to work despite the government shutdown. The Deputy Undersecretary for Management told employees that they would receive one paycheck in mid-February, but that pay beyond that could not be guaranteed. Donald Trump sent a letter to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi today saying that he was canceling her upcoming trip overseas to Belgium, Egypt, and Afghanistan. Trump made the move in retaliation for Pelosi's request that the State of the Union address be postponed until the government shutdown is resolved. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Facebook. Overnight, Facebook deleted hundreds of pages that it said were run by employees of Sputnik. 75 Sputnik employees also have been blacklisted for posting on these pages. The reason that Facebook gave is that they were either inauthentic or promoted anti-NATO views or both. Is Facebook continuing its war on independent and alternative media, and in particular on Russian media? We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Alex Rubenstein. He is a writer for Mint Press News. Alex Rubenstein, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Alex, when we start to dig in and sort of understand what Facebook did here, again, this was pretty big news in the corporate-owned media that's been promoting the anti-Russian narrative for the last couple of years. When you look into it, though, it's quite something. There was no hiding about these pages. Let's help the audience understand what the pages were, why they were objectionable, and how they got taken down, because we see, again, the intervention of the Atlantic Council or the Atlantic Council Digital Forensic Research Lab. Go ahead.
Sure. So Facebook's statement is incredibly opaque, as is usual for their statements on these kinds of bans. It says that there were 289 pages and 75 accounts that were banned, and they had just shy of about 800,000 followers. And this is where it's kind of interesting, and just this very first fact on the blog post of Facebook, they don't specify which accounts had how many followers. And from my understanding, there were all kinds of, I guess you could describe them as special interest accounts, like traveling in Moldova or something. So it's like a travel page. But then some of them were associated more closely with the Sputnik brand, and they don't specify which ones had this huge amount of followers. So I suspect that it was the main Sputnik accounts that had the big numbers, and then these other ones, you know, maybe like 100 followers there, 100 or 200 followers over there. And yeah, what we're seeing is, again, the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Research Lab playing a role in the ban of pages from Facebook and other social media. This has been kind of par for the course over the past year and a half or so or longer, that Facebook and other social media has really increased or ramped up its censorship efforts. And that's largely in response to outcry from Capitol Hill, from the media that has been pressuring Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Google to really crack down on alternative voices. Explicitly, this is done. Facebook noted that these pages were sharing anti-NATO content. So it really shows how the social media giants, the Silicon Valley companies, are taking politics into their own hands in many ways. And they're doing so in collaboration with the Atlantic Council, which is a neoconservative think tank that's funded by Gulf monarchies, defense contractors, and really is just one of the worst actors in Washington when it comes to imperialism, you know, United States imperialism abroad.
Just to jump in there, Alex, guess who else funds Atlantic Council? Yes, that would be NATO. NATO funds it. So, Atlantic Council tells Facebook these are anti-NATO pages amongst their other, you know, sort of sins. They get their funding from NATO. I mean, I'm looking at the Facebook official statement, removing coordinated inauthentic behavior from Russia. Sounds bad, right? Sounds really, really dangerous. Here's part of that statement. Advertising. This is Facebook's own words. Around $135,000 in spending. Ooh. For ads on Facebook paid for in euros, rubles, and U.S. dollars. The first ad ran when? In October 2013, and the most recent ad ran in January 2019. And then they go on, we have not completed a review of the organic content coming from these accounts. Well, there's one thing that just jumps out, Alex, about this meaningful statement about the coordinated behavior of Russia and Sputnik in particular. The first ad ran in October 2013. Sputnik did not exist in October 2013. Sputnik did not exist until mid-November 2014. Again, it's amazing. Sputnik's power, it had inauthentic behavior before Sputnik existed.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you know, the other thing that strikes me about that statement is they say that these are Russian origin accounts or Russian origin. And honestly, this seems like a European thing, and Sputnik has offices all over. So I highly doubt that these social media editors were all Russians. I mean, I'm sure many of them were from those areas, Moldova or the Balkans or wherever else these operations were going on.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? By the way, the Atlantic Council reached out to the Sputnik editor-in-chief of the Latvia Bureau of Sputnik, and they said, are you creating these, or are Sputnik employees creating these pages like, you know, travel to Latvia, Latvian cuisine, you know, general interest things, the weather in Latvia? And the Sputnik editor-in-chief, according to the Atlantic Council, quote, confirm that Sputnik ran the Latvian focus pages. And then they go on. Open source evidence shows that Rusia Sugudnya employees ran some of the other pages and were aware of even more. Guess what? It wasn't just open sources. The Sputnik bureau editors said, yes, we did this. Our employees did this. It's kind of promoting for people interested in Latvian cuisine or Latvian travel. Sputnik employees, including Latvian Sputnik employees, are posting articles about that, these general interest topics, which Sputnik Latvia News also covers. I mean, that's the subterranean dangerous conspiracy that the Atlantic Council, funded by NATO, has now unmasked.
Yeah, and really what the editor's comments show is that this was not some kind of nefarious Russian plot. It's not connected to the private company, the Internet Research Agency. It's nothing like that. What it is a marketing strategy, and it's used by a lot of people who are actually run big pages on Facebook. For example, the bans against the alternative media outlets, the Free Thought Project and the Anti-Media and so on. These were done for similar reasons, because there were separate accounts that would promote stuff from the main account, right? And that's what Facebook considers coordinated inauthentic. So it's really just like this is Facebook being opaque again in order to drum up anti-Russian sentiment. Really what this reveals is that Sputnik had some savvy marketers working for them. But as somebody myself, I used to run social media or help run social media for RT America. And I mean, I saw firsthand the deception. Twitter came to RT with a ad package that was too expensive for the 2016 election. So we turned it down. Later on, we went and we purchased a smaller ad package. And then after the January 2017 ODNI report came out, which blamed RT and Sputnik for spreading radical discontent and so on, then we were banned from advertising on Twitter, which was, again, a totally disingenuous move. And really, that ODNI document in 2017, that was like the fountainhead of everything else that we've seen in the realm of social media censorship since then. And since then, we've really seen tons of money from oligarchs like Pierre Omidyar, George Soros.
You cannot call them oligarchs unless they're Russian.
Right.
There's a rule. Billionaires are only oligarchs if they're Russians.
Right. Anyways, these American billionaires, are pouring huge amounts of money into these private organizations to work as fact checkers and to rate news agencies and have their ratings installed as software on computers and phones and in libraries and universities to basically materialize their rankings. So if you're ranked bad, it's you can't get access to that website at a university or on your phone or whatever. And really, this is being done in partnership with groups like the Atlantic Council, in partnership with really some of the worst players of the neoconservative movement, like Bill Kristol.
Now, Facebook is also partnering with the Family Research Council. They're getting these ultra-right, anti-abortion, even anti-divorce groups so that they can also monitor and decide what's authentic or inauthentic when you talk about, say, women's rights or abortion rights. I mean, because Facebook was being beaten up first by the government when it said, hey, the Russians didn't have any big impact on the 2016 election, if any at all, then they were beaten up and then they created, manufactured, yeah, it really was big and bad and scary. Then the Republicans and the conservatives said Facebook lean left, so now they're partnering with ultra-rightists like the Family Research Council, again, farming out and allowing others to act as the filter to decide what's authentic and inauthentic. Alex, you know, because you were in Washington, D.C. right before the anti-Nazi, anti-Klan rally August 12th in Lafayette Park, that people who were organizing against the Unite the Right rally, they were real people. They were called Russian bots, and their Facebook pages were taken down a week before the anti-fascist protest.
Right, yeah, and that was just kind of like, you know, that protest turned out to not be much, but, you know, they could have put people in danger. One of the organizers went on Eugene Perrier's show, By Any Means Necessary, and he was saying, you know, the fact that all of the people who RSVP'd to our page, which has been deleted, to oppose these neo-Nazi groups, the page is gone, so there's no way to connect to them. And what that does is that puts people in danger. So that's a clear example of blowback from the censorship. Another clear example is, you know, just run-of-the-mill liberal articles being rated as like false by fact checkers like the Weekly Standard, which is Bill Kristol's neoconservative magazine, which went defunct at the end of last year. And then there's, you know, the Russian bot trackers, which Bill Kristol also played a role in, and other like ventures. There's so many ventures, and for some reason they all have the same former intelligence operatives on the board of directors. It's really it's like a massive scheme, rife with tons of front groups for all of the usual suspects, really.
The Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, the right wing. Again, we're talking with Alex Rubenstein. We're talking about the new censorship by Facebook of hundreds of Facebook pages and accounts by Sputnik or Sputnik employees in Europe. 75 people now who are not hiding. They were openly Sputnik employees. They were posting on, if you want to travel to Georgia or to Latvia, if you're interested in Latvian or Georgian cuisine or travel or weather, nothing was hidden. And yet they're taken down. And the impression is left that this was this, as you put it, nefarious conspiracy, subterranean. Again, Facebook writes, today we removed 364 Facebook pages and accounts for engaging in coordinated, inauthentic behavior as a part of a network that originated in Russia and operated in the Baltic, Central Asia, the Caucasus, and Central and Eastern European countries. Sounds bad, right? These were pages advertising menus in Latvia, what to eat in Georgia, what the weather is like. None of it's hidden. And yet what we're witnessing, because I would say, Alex, in our last minute, most people are not going to dig deep and understand how shallow and what really this amounts to a frame up. This is a frame up of individual journalists who work for Sputnik and a frame up of Sputnik. Most people are going to think like, again, there must be fire if there's this much smoke. Go ahead. 1 minute left. Take us out.
Yeah, really, all you need to say is coordinated inauthentic activity from Russia, which for, you know, alarm bells to start ringing out in Washington, D.C. This is part of, like, I just want to drive home that this is part of a larger trend. The information warfare from Russia that the United States has been decrying for years, we are leading in disinformation efforts. We saw with the Alabama Project, Project Birmingham, Democrats were engaging in this exact kind of, not the same behavior as Sputnik, but like the behavior that was attributed to the Internet Research Agency. And really, we're seeing that, like, when it comes to the new Cold War, this information sphere online is the front lines.
And talk about false news or fake news, overused term, but I just want to go out, Alex Rubenstein, with these facts. Facebook, again, has found that Sputnik employees were taking out ads that were inauthentic a year before Sputnik even existed. Obviously, that's not true. That's fake. That's obviously fake. And the other part of the story that you alluded to was Twitter, again, to great blaring headlines, banned Sputnik from taking out any more ads on Twitter after the nefarious Russian so-called interference. And the fact is, Sputnik never took out one ad, not one single ad with Twitter. So Sputnik was banned from doing something that it's never done and never requested to do. Again, the point being to leave the impression that the government is finally taking action to stop Russian media, alternative media's nefarious activity. Anyway, that was the voice of Alex Rubenstein. Alex joined us from Washington. He's a writer for Mint Press News. Stay with us. We're going to now have a short clip from an interview earlier today where we talked with Ford Fisher. Ford Fisher is well known for live streaming events that get largely ignored by mainstream media. His page wasn't deleted, but several specific videos vanished during an earlier Facebook purge. Ford Fisher, we have this takedown, this big media announcement about a takedown by Facebook of Facebook pages associated with Sputnik or Sputnik employees in Europe. But it's not simply about Sputnik or Sputnik employees. There's a trend, there's a pattern, and you too have been the target. Let's talk about the big picture.
Yeah, so actually it was just this weekend that I was participated in an event called United for Common Ground. It was an independent media summit in Houston, Texas, where a number of people in the independent media kind of gathered together to talk about how we would sort of fight back against social media censorship. And so these were independent organizations that had, you know, of course, nothing to do with Sputnik or Russian media or anything like that. But a number of actual independent news pages have been censored, where either individual videos are taken down, where they're marked as spam, particularly if they promote alternative social media sites such as Steemit or Minds, which are alternatives to Facebook and YouTube. And some people have had their pages deleted outright, such as the Anti-Media and the Free Thought Project. So we kind of gathered together to talk about that exact issue. And I think kind of the overlap or the thing that seems continuous from that situation, which had there was a purge of about 800 Facebook pages then, to my understanding is that today there was something like 300 pages removed, that and I'm not particularly familiar with any of them, to be honest, but of the ones that went down today. But the common thread is that the mainstream media tends to simply report whatever Facebook puts out as its statement about these situations. So when the 800 pages went down, Facebook sort of branded them all as spam, this happening in October. And of course, I'm not familiar with all 800, but I did personally know many of the people who had them. The pages had a specifically anti-war bent, a specifically police accountability bent. Some were called things like police the police, right? Many of them had a pro-cannabis bent, right? I mean, some of them were about marijuana specifically. So many of them were by, you know, genuine people and that kind of thing. And with the exception of a few outlets such as Rolling Stone magazine, most mainstream media kind of regurgitated Facebook's press release on the subject without actually trying to find those content creators and speaking to them. So when it comes to what happened today, I think it's quite possible that actual bad actors or deliberately misleading pages, perhaps by Sputnik, were taken down. But we haven't seen a complete list of the full 300-plus pages, and I'd be interested to see whether there are content creators like similar to the friends that I have who might have been taken down with it and don't have a way to speak out if it was done in error.
Ford Fisher is our guest. Ford Fisher is the founder of the media startup News to Share. Ford, one of the groups that Facebook is partnering with to filter out or decide what's authentic or inauthentic news is the think tank here in Washington, D.C. In fact, it's right around the corner from us on K Street. We're on K Street. It's called the Atlantic Council. It's funded partly by NATO. And so it's weird that Facebook has a partner, Atlantic Council, funded by NATO, and then Facebook decides, without knowing each and every one of these pages, we haven't yet been able to do any sort of investigation. This is more or less breaking news. But Facebook then decides that these pages that have content critical of NATO in Europe are worthy of being taken down and perhaps being inauthentic. It does smack of a political agenda.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I haven't been able to see the actual content that was taken down today. And I'd be inclined to say that it's generally fine if Facebook wants a prerogative, which is taking down activity that is sincerely and genuine. That is, if somebody is one thing and they're posing as a different thing. What isn't good is if the motivation is political, which, like you said, it's sort of breaking news, so it kind of remains to be seen. But my opinion of the independent news outlets in America that have been taken down and are sincerely independent is that they tend to have an anti-war critical of those sorts of things bent. And that seems to have motivated them in our case here in the U.S. And so it is worth noting that the Atlantic Council, of course, gets military funding, and then the Atlantic Council is advising and in financial transactions with Facebook. So this has kind of created a complicated situation where there's a little bit of a gray line, you know, between Facebook and being sort of a state entity, right? Is Facebook kind of ipso facto taking, you know, and allowing the state to take an advisory position on what content goes on it? And so that kind of censorship then becomes something other than just a private company regulating what it allows on its forum. So I think that that's something that needs to be explored more carefully, and I would like to see more transparency kind of in that process. So I looked at Facebook's blog related to this situation, how they basically put out some screenshots, some examples of the sorts of pages they took down. They didn't give a complete list of the pages or a complete list of the kinds of posts. It was just sort of specific examples. But the one thing that they didn't give any examples of is which actual advisors gave them this information. So it has a few little sentences referencing that they were working with their sort of trusted partners on this situation and that they reported it to relevant law enforcement. But those are the areas that they actually haven't communicated a whole lot about. And I think that especially if what they're going after is transparency among people using their service. I think that it would be useful to have transparency in who is helping them regulate that exact issue.
That's critically important, actually. And that's the other thing about being, quote, an informal government agency or a quasi-government, using nonprofits that are funded by government agencies to be the determiners of what's authentic and what's inauthentic. So if it was actually the government, there would be some official protocols for transparency and or at least oversight, even if it's not real. There's none in the case of Facebook. Here, Fort Fisher, here's another story, which is about how this entire phenomena has evolved ever since Mark Zuckerberg originally said it was kind of nonsense that false Facebook pages were impacting the 2016 election. He got trashed for that by Congress. Then they started backing up and they started giving examples about how impactful, in fact, even minor amounts of money spent on Facebook ads might be. Here's another story. It comes from the Wall Street Journal from about 2 weeks ago. Facebook, Twitter turned to right-leaning groups to help referee political speech. Right-leaning is sort of a misnomer here. Among the initiatives, Facebook has privately sought advice from the Family Research Council, a conservative Christian public policy group, and its president, Tony Perkins. Again, here we have a situation where Facebook is now, I mean, Family Research Council is not right-leaning. It's very, very, very far right. It opposes abortion. It opposes divorce, basically. Again, as they kowtow to the dominant narrative, where's the public's real guarantee? Where is the transparency? They select groups from the Atlantic Council, funded by NATO, or now these far-right organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really, I think that Facebook is sort of in between a rock and a hard place. I will grant them some credit here, which is that to some extent, I'm not sure that they wanted to be doing these sorts of censoring activities and taking on all of these different advisors. Them having these different nonprofits over their shoulder, especially ones that have some kind of state influence, probably threatens their sovereignty as a private company. Companies tend not to want to be regulated by somebody else. They tend not to want to take down, you know, I was about to say their customers, but really the users of Facebook are products. They tend not to want to eliminate their products, so to speak. So I'm not sure that Facebook is necessarily happy to be doing this. However, there has been an enormous amount of pressure on them because of the 2016 election and because of kind of the meddling narrative that I think that they feel like they have to respond to it. So then they start censoring and they start bringing things down and then as a result of it, they've been accused of exactly that, which they are doing. So it seems like then they try to balance it out in the left-right American political spectrum by saying, oh, okay, we've taken on some advisors that are helping us take down this content, and then those advisors happen to, in the American sense, be somewhere on the left. So they say, oh, let's throw on some right-wing ones. I think that them having a more transparent process, perhaps just a more simple standard that's a little bit more apolitical, about misrepresentation rather than about like sort of quality of content would probably be a better standard. And I think that they may be just struggling to hit the sweet spot that will avoid the government formally passing regulations that hurt them. It seems like they're doing most of this stuff as a way to kind of appease the state into not legally going after them. So at least right now they kind of have the wiggle room to experiment in different ways, but they might be in a worse off situation for them if they do nothing and then the government starts passing anti-Facebook or Facebook regulating bills or bills that formalize that relationship between the state and Facebook rather than having this kind of middleman of the nonprofits.
Well, that's all the time we have. We were joined earlier from Washington, D.C. by Alex Rubenstein. Alex is a writer for Mint Press News. That was the voice of Ford Fisher. Ford is the founder of the media startup News to Share. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Kevin, Paul, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you. We have a lot to talk about. Let's start with the federal investigation of Alabama prisons. Kevin, you want to start us off?
Yeah, so here in Alabama, there's been this federal investigation ongoing with the Justice Department looking at Alabama prisons, and in particular, as local coverage indicates, they had been doing an investigation that particularly looks for whether people's constitutional rights are being violated in these state facilities in Alabama. And they point to particularly wanting to see how much prisoners are at risk of harm and sexual abuse by other prisoners, sort of excessive force and abuse that they might endure from correctional staff or prison guards, and the extent of the lack of sanitary, secure, and safe living conditions inside of the facilities. And we talk about these issues every week. We know that in Alabama, it's pretty bad. I think Alabama, Paul can correct me if I get this wrong, but it's the worst overcrowded in the country when it comes to facilities, if you go state by state. So we know it's horrendous. I think what's interesting about this coming up and being a topic of conversation right now, there was a filing in the investigation, and it gave people a first glimpse at the type of investigation that the Justice Department might be conducting. But we remember that Jeff Sessions from Alabama was running the Justice Department. And I do wonder, when I look at what's being reported here, and we talk about, it talks about delays, the state correctional department in Alabama is saying that all of these delays are sort of unfair to them, and that really the Justice Department needs to conclude this investigation. They're using the delays as a way to pressure the Justice Department to end whatever it's doing. But I do wonder if just with Jeff Sessions running the Justice Department the past years, couple years, if that ended up being something where he was assisting the Alabama state corrections officers, protecting them from an investigation. And now with him gone, maybe some of the bureaucracy is able to get back to this investigation.
Paul Wright, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that's interesting, though, is that typically the federal government has been lackluster at best in terms of its investigations of prison abuse and overcrowding and neglect and murders and deaths and that historically. They've never been at the real forefront of doing much around these cases to begin with. And Jeff Sessions, in addition to being from Alabama, has never historically been a big proponent or advocate of any type of enforcement or accountability for law enforcement, even at the best of times. So, you know, so I think in some respects, that's just kind of, in some respects, the inactivity and the lack of action, I think, is kind of more typical in these federal investigations than not. But again, we've also got just Sessions in particular had a lot of hostility towards any type of federal oversight of law enforcement in general.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright from Prison Legal News and also Kevin Gostala from Shadowproof, shadowproof.com. Kevin, I'm looking at your website, another story. House Subcommittee report highlights, quote, culture of fear and retaliation in federal prisons. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so here's this report that was done. You probably haven't read anything about it in the press, and that's because it was done by Republicans who were looking at and examining the nature and the state of federal prisons. I think it was conducted along with the development and progression of the First Step Act when they were considering that modest reform bill that did pass in 2018. My colleague Brian tried to get a copy of this report to cover, and the Democrats wouldn't provide it at all. So he had to wait until finally one of the Republicans did post it to the internet, but you probably didn't read about it. And I think it's remarkable just given how indifferent and how much inattention there's been to prison abuse by our politicians, that the Republican staff of this National Security Committee did a full examination of federal prisons and has some pretty, you know, incredible statements here just about every prison facility basically being its own island unto itself within BOP, you know, highlighting things that, you know, between all three of us, we know these to be the reality, but we probably don't typically expect that members of our political class will admit that, you know, every one of these facilities have management cultures that are cultures of fear and retaliation that prevent whistleblowers from bringing forward abuse, and that usually you've got officials who are running these facilities who are protected and blocked from any sorts of accountability, and that investigations are totally undermined, and that this report actually documents that this culture of abuse, you know, while we could probably go further, they say that it's been pretty much this bad if you go all the way back to 2004. So that lays a lot of responsibility on the people who are supposed to be oversight. That suggests and confirms that Congress really hasn't been doing what it should be doing in order to protect prisoners. So I think it's significant. And I think in terms, one last point would be in terms of the First Step Act, I think this sort of report is important for people who thought they might get some kind of help, because it suggests that they probably might not get the kind of assistance they were looking for, because there are things within the First Step Act that were championed that involve basically enforcing existing rules, things like being put in a facility within 500 miles of family, things like that. And that comes down to the culture of the people who are running the Bureau of Prison Facilities. You know, if they don't want to do this, you can have individuals who are running these facilities, these management cultures, you know, they can do that. If they don't want to make you eligible for pre-release custody, then that can be their choice. Wardens can do that at their own discretion.
If you want to read more about this story, you can go to shadowproof.com. The title of the article is right on the front page of Shadowproof. Is House Subcommittee Report Highlights Culture of Fear and Retaliation in Federal Prisons. We're talking from Chicago with Kevin Gostala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and is the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Paul Wright, this is about federal prisons. For people who might be just tuning in for the first time and hearing this segment on Loud and Clear, the segment that we run every week called Criminal Injustice, and people who may not have heard our earlier episodes thus, would they be wrong in thinking that this is a problem that is in the federal prisons in a more pronounced way than, say, other kinds of prisons, state prisons, local jails?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think that the American prison and jail system is characterized by its pretty total brutality, dehumanization of the prisoners and the staff as well that are caged inside them. And, you know, the bigger thing, of course, is I think the total lack of transparency these institutions have and the lack of accountability to anyone. You know, there really is no functioning oversight of our nation's prisons and jails. I mean, litigation is a very imperfect, haphazard, and hit-or-miss means of accountability, usually only after bad things have happened. And, you know, that's been kind of the reality. It's been this way for a long time. And I think the bigger thing, of course, is that our political class, the total abject cowardness that we've seen from the executive and the legislative branches of this country that have allowed our prisons and jails to not only balloon into the biggest cages of human misery and known to human history. And, you know, just putting things into context, you know, the United States today cages as an absolute number and percentage of its population more people than any other country in the world has, more than Nazi Germany did at the height of the Hitler regime, more than Soviet Russia did at the height of the Stalinist purges in the 1930s. So that's both in percentages and absolute terms. And the difference is that we have even less in the way of accountability and transparency than even those totalitarian regimes did. And no one in this country, in our political class, has any interest in ensuring that either prisoners have any type of humane treatment. And I think it's interesting is that, you know, we've gone, you know, the First Step Act has gotten a lot of good publicity, and I think deservedly so, as being just what the name says, a First Step Act. But it's interesting is what it doesn't do. And, you know, bringing about accountability, giving prisoners actual rights that are enforceable, these are all things that it markedly does not do. And some of the biggest rollbacks of prisoner rights in American history still remains the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which was signed into law in 1996 by President Bill Clinton, that removed the ability, for the most part, of federal courts to do anything about unconstitutional prison conditions. And the reality has been, for most of American history, that judicial oversight, as imperfect and haphazard as it might be, has been the closest thing we've had to any type of oversight of our nation's prisons and jails. And Congress and the president made a big point of stripping them of that. And no one is, and here we are 20 plus years later, no one's talking about undoing that critical piece of legislation.
That's Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul and Kevin Gustala about the American criminal justice system. We call this segment Criminal Injustice. I want to ask you about another story. Let's start with you, Kevin. Here it is. It's in Reuters. Error in U.S. prisons law means well-behaved inmates wait longer for release. This is like, what? Washington, Reuters. U.S. prisoners who were expecting earlier release for good behavior, thanks to a new criminal justice law enacted last month, must keep waiting due to an error in the bill, said activists working with the White House to fix the mistake. Potentially thousands of inmates could be affected by the error in the First Step Act. Go ahead.
I mean, is it a mistake or is it just carelessness? Because most of the people who are involved in passing this law are inattentive and they don't really care. It's not like a top priority. The only reason why you probably get a First Step Act passed in 2018 is because of grassroots pressure. And however it was drafted, there are always ways in which it is the way in which legislation eventually makes it out of the machine of Congress and to the desk of a president. It goes through so many different drafts and redrafts. And probably you could say that if you asked a lot of people who were senators or representatives, they didn't read the entire legislation closely. Most of our politicians don't actually read every line of bills closely, which is, you know, likely why you have this kind of an error. And it's devastating because, as Paul was saying, this doesn't do a whole lot to reform the system. It doesn't really do anything to change the nature of the system that is inherently abusive. And what people were really depending upon were things like changing, like getting more credit for good behavior. And if that's not functioning, then people aren't going to see the kind of impact from this law that they were hoping. And right now we have the government shutdown ongoing. So there's absolutely no way that anyone can move into action right now to correct this bureaucratic error. Any of these people who were supposed to be out this year or, you know, maybe even next year because of having these credits put into their record, I mean, I don't know if they see that come in any timely manner.
Yeah, it's really, really something. Advocates of the law, this is about the First Step Act. Advocates of the law expected the bill's enactment into law, that several thousand inmates at least would get their freedom right away, in fact, in time for the 2018 holiday season. It's, wow, talk about the impact on human beings of this kind of either inattention or, quote, mistake. We all know it's a mistake, and yet the remedy not immediate. No urgency, I guess, Paul.
Yes, I think that's part of the thing, is that we've never had any urgency when it comes to our nation's 2.5 million prisoners. You know, it's very much viewed as an expendable population, known in our political class, you know, even really purports to care about them. So, you know, it's definitely, I think it's definitely been a very dismal episode of American history, and it has been for decades now. And sadly, it doesn't seem to be getting any better.
Let's go on to another story. I'm looking at the headline. Paul Wright, bad forensic science is putting innocent people in prison. That's big.
Yes, and actually this has been going on literally since the invention of forensic science. And I think the bigger thing in is thinking about this is also an oxymoron, is a lot of things that people think about as science is actually anything but. And I think we have what we call the CSI effect, where I think people see these television shows with these purported forensic investigators. They think there's science behind them. There's scientists saying things. And the reality is most of the time, the so-called forensics people are just a bunch of cops with the lab coat on, and they're not scientists. They don't have scientific training, and they don't perform scientific tests. And the whole forensics thing is, in some respects, almost like the prop department at a movie studio, where their whole job is to give props to prosecutors to gain conviction. And we've seen over the years, time after time after time, lots of what had been, quote, accepted forms of evidence, unquote, such as bullet identification, bite mark evidence, whole fields of so-called forensic science have collapsed as a house of cards built on a fraud and a charade and no science at all. And we've seen this time after time again. And all too often this happens because prosecutors lack the evidence, conventional evidence, to get convictions. So they use, you know, basically they cook up with the police so-called forensic evidence to supposedly prove guilt. And all too often it collapses and it's later exposed years or decades later as having no basis in science and not being scientific at all. And we see this time after time. This has happened a lot in the case of arson science, for example, where over the last 30 years, there actually has been more studies going on in fires, both accidental and otherwise, and how fires spread and stuff like that, where a lot of people that have been convicted of arson, especially where deaths have occurred as a result of those arsons, later on, decades later, with a better science and actual science going into this, it turns out that the so-called arson convictions were in fact accidental. They weren't arsons. But we've seen this across the board. Fred Whitehurst, a number of years ago, exposed what a fraud and charade the FBI crime lab was, that most of the so-called technicians were just FBI agents with no scientific training. They were literally making up results to bolster whatever theory the prosecutor had. So, you know, unfortunately, that's kind of the norm that we see nationally.
I want to talk about the story, the headline. And Paul, this seems to be something that you would be sort of very knowledgeable about. Washington State prisoners protest poor food. We've talked a lot in the past about the problem of food in prisons, but here's a protest. Let's talk about that. We have about 60 seconds left.
Yeah, so basically, in April 2018, prisoners at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla went on a 10-day hunger strike to protest the bad food. And I can say, having spent 17 years in Washington prisons, the food steadily got worse while I was in prison, and it hasn't gotten any better. And this is the norm. I mean, we see that prisoners are steadily fed diets that are high in carbohydrates and starch with little nutritional value and even less flavor. A lot of times it's rotten, isn't fit for human consumption, and even worse. So, but then they say that every country is only 3 missed meals away from a revolution. And bad food is consistently one of the big complaints about prisoners that prisoners have. And I think it's one of the things that foments unrest at every level.
We've been speaking with Kevin Gostala from Chicago. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we've also been talking with Paul Wright, founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. We talk to Kevin and Paul every Thursday in this segment called Criminal Injustice. In this episode of Criminal Injustice, we're going to go now to 2 special guests to talk about a situation in New York City and its impact, not only on the people in New York, but around the country. We're now joined from New York by Carl Bowen and Tag Harmon. They are members of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee and Stop the Raids New York City. Welcome to both of you.
Appreciate that. Glad to be on with you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Carl Bowen, let's start with you real quick. We have a limited amount of time. We're going to talk now about the 120 Bronx gang indicted in the largest takedown in New York City history 2 years ago. Tell us real quick what this story is and what's the latest.
Right, absolutely. So as you said, it was a massive raid in the Bronx. It was in Eastchester Gardens Housing Project. multi-agency, several million dollars in equipment. They went in with helicopters, flashbang grenades, real incredibly militarized intervention in a case that the press at the time and the NYPD and the mayor's office made a huge deal out of, but ultimately was stretching over a very long period of time, involving kids who were working at Home Depot, like auto shops, really out of whack with the amount of resource that was spent in surveilling them for over a decade in some cases, and that was spent in snatching up these 120 young people from across the Bronx. So that was April 2016. I think everyone from that ended up taking plea deals, spending time in federal detention. And some of those people are now getting out. We're holding a welcome home event, which I'm sure we'll say some more words about later, next weekend for some of the people from that and other raids that have now been released. But yeah, that's the latest.
Okay. Tag Harmon is our other guest. We're talking to Carl Bowen and Tag Harmon. They're both members of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee and Stop the Raids New York City. Tag Harmon, this was not an isolated incident, this massive raid. Talk about how this fits in with the broader trend towards the militarization of the police.
Yeah, definitely. So this happens to have been the one that's said to be the largest so-called gang raid in New York City history. But just before it, a couple years before it, in the Grant housing in Harlem, was the previous largest so-called gang raid in New York City history, with about 100 individuals being snatched up from the Harlem community behind that. Since then, there have been several dozens, really, of these so-called gang raids. And as was mentioned, the very draconian and highly militarized nature of these raids, you know, we're seeing what the 1033 program, for example, and other such programs that allow for these law enforcement agencies to act as occupying militarized forces in our community. This is what it looks like on the ground in its barest face. So as far as the longer history of this kind of activity, you know, many legal scholars, lawyers, journalists, organizers, the community at large feel that what is happening essentially is, after the stop and frisk policies of the NYPD were deemed unconstitutional, this is the NYPD's reaction to being told that they can't just indiscriminately stop people and search their persons, you know, with no reason. So this is their reaction. This is just another way to massively, you know, surveil communities and to target communities and individuals that have been targeted since the NYPD began.
All right. That's Tag Harmon and Carl Bowen. I want to follow up on that a little bit. Bill de Blasio, when he was then candidate Bill de Blasio, opposed a stop and frisk. Stop and frisk was overturned by the court. It was demonstrably racist. It was targeting young people of color in particular, hundreds of thousands of people. And yet here we have de Blasio, liberal, progressive. Carl Bowen, it seems like same old, same old.
I think you're right to a large extent, but I think the one crucial difference and part of the reason that the sequel to Stop and Frisk has been much more successful in evading the kind of scrutiny and challenge that Tag was describing is that it's much more covert. There's less visible presence. You don't have this spectacle of people being harassed on the street. What's been happening instead, as part of efforts centered around the NYPD's Operation Crew Cut, is you've got a huge amount of social media surveillance, often picking up on things that are incredibly innocuous, someone liking a particular photo or someone else's status. Even the mere fact of people being friends with each other on Facebook has been sufficient to land some people in court and then in prison after these raids. It's also based on much more low-key in-person inquiries. So people are being scooped up by NYPD officers in the city and not told their rights, not told that there should be a parent or a guardian present when they're being questioned. And are leaned on very heavily to give names of people they know throughout the community. So it very quickly becomes, as it was in the Bronx 120 case, an entire generation of people that get targeted, but in a way that's hidden from view and made more difficult to resist.
That was the voice of Carl Bowen. Tig Harmon, we only have about a minute left. What are the upcoming activities that all of you have planned to support the people who are arrested and their families?
So we've got a Welcome Home fundraiser coming up. That is next Saturday. That's the 26th of January. That's in Jalopy Theater, which is in Red Hook, Brooklyn. The quickest way to find out about what's going on at the Welcome Home fundraiser would be to go to welcomehome.nyc. That's the Welcome Home website. And there you can find the event on social media. You can find the email address, which is stoptheragenyc@protonmail.com. And you can find the quickest way to donate to the efforts. All of the funds are going directly to those who have been impacted by these devastating raids. That is, those who are inside, those are on who are on the outside, and their families, you know, who've been caged behind this targeting of specific communities, racialized communities throughout the city. And again, that's welcomehome.nyc. And the fundraiser is going to involve a number of performances. We've got a special guest performer that we just got confirmation from recently. So I know people are going to be amped to see what's going on there. We've got a raffle and a number of other activities going on at Jalopy Theater in Brooklyn.
Excellent. That was Tig Harmon. We were talking to Tig and Carl Bowen. They are members of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee and Stop the Raids New York City. Earlier in our segment, we were talking from Chicago with Kevin Gastala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. We were joined, as we are every Thursday, also from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.